Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 7, Prisoner Chats. My name is Magellan, and although I may be an uncoordinated youth rebelling against nothing I can define, they are an established, successful, secure member of the establishment, turning a pawn and biting the hand that feeds them. It's Alan.
Wait. What are you saying about me there? What's going on?
I'm saying that you're you got a very nice shave.
I love a big frothy shave.
I love plot points that are relevant.
You really, like, when in watching The Prisoner, have to accept that, like, this is nothing. What I'm looking at is not anything. Why are we shaving this man? Because why not? Shut up.
Yeah. How you doing, Alan?
I'm doing so well, Magellan. Thank you for asking.
You're welcome for asking. Glad that I asked.
I like this new recording schedule that we've configured for ourselves. We got ourselves on a nice Sunday afternoon tick. And, you know, I got all my stuff done this weekend. Nice. Been relaxing, maxing, all cool.
So you were playing b-ball outside of the school, or?
No, it's closed right now.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
It's super closed. I miss b-ball, though. I haven't played b-ball in a hot and warm minute.
Did you play? You've played b-ball?
Absolutely. What?
Okay.
Yeah. When I was a kid, all of my family friends were really, 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 really into basketball. Oh. And they were like, we're going to get you into basketball. And I was like, I don't know how to do sports. But they would force me to play sports until I was at least decent. And it's one of those things when you're a kid that you're like, this is the worst thing that'll ever happen to me in life. And then you get older and you're like, oh, that was actually really nice. They were being considerate and helping me develop a new hobby. Thanks, guys.
I once got up to the plate in a baseball game at a family reunion that may have been a family reunion adjoining a different family reunion or something. I don't know how there were enough people for a full baseball game. And I definitely struck out or hit a bad hit and then just ran away from
life and all my problems. Yeah. So fair.
Different sports experiences. Well, we don't talk about, this isn't a sports show.
But even though the last two episodes have opened with us talking in depth about sports.
I guess in this second time in a row I've talked about baseball, so.
Yeah, baseball.
I guess I've got some unresolved baseball issues. But we do talk about television. Specifically, we talk about 1967's The Prisoner. And we have watched the final episode of The Prisoner for this week, along with a documentary about the creation of The Prisoner that we'll talk about in the second half. But first off, let's talk about that finale. It's called Fallout. It was written and directed by the creator of the show and its star, Patrick McGoohan. It originally aired February 1st, 1968. Alan, what happened, as best as you can describe it, in Fallout?
This is more than ever, I'm glad that we have good summaries via various wikis and Amazon, because, ooh, baby. In this episode, after witnessing the trials of Number 2 and Number 48, as well as meeting the president of the assembly, Number 6 escapes during the chaos that follows.
So, finales are hard, right?
They're hard.
I think out of everything in television, beginnings and ends are obviously the most difficult things to pull off. Mm-hmm. And I think especially finales are difficult because since television is, if you think about it, it's one of the few popular media that we still consume in some cases in a spaced out over time way. I can't really think about other stories, because it used to be what's that Dickens book? Tale of Two Cities? Yep. You know, he publishes a chapter a month or whatever in the magazine, or however he did that.
The best way to read that.
Right. But TV is in our modern time, I think the only contiguous piece of work that we consume in that way, that's narrative. And so people build expectations about, everybody wants something out of the finale. They want questions answered. They want things resolved. And so I guess through that lens, before we talk about what happened, what did you think of Fallout as a finale to this show? Did it meet your expectations? Did it do what you were hoping it would do?
Good question. I did like it a lot. It's probably in my like top three favorite episodes of the show, just because of its both audacity and confidence with which it barrels towards a conclusion, like with disregard for continuity, sense, you know, just a overall like commitment to the rest of the series. It feels like somebody said, hey, we want to end this show. How do you end the show? And instead of thinking like, well, how do we connect all these pieces together? They just said, no, how do we get to the ending that we want? What brings us to this like triumphant moment that we're looking for? And they figured it out, and I applaud them for it. I think in, you know, we'll talk about the historical, like where the show fell in 1968 and how it was received. I mean, but I don't think it's that out there these days for a show to like do the thing it's been hinting at for a while, even though it's in kind of a reckless way, you could say. I think that's more common now than ever, that just shows are like, it's over, we're out of seasons, frick, right. Everyone's happy. And that just happens. So it makes more sense in the modern day. And like, I totally get the whole Patrick McGoohan having to not go outside for a couple of days thing.
Right, because people were coming to his house asking him what the heck happened.
Yeah. I understand people thinking that, but I would never, I can't watch this and think like, you know, there was something missing or there was something I really wanted that I didn't get. What about you?
Yeah, I think it's hard to retrieve the context and view it through the context of like thinking that it's a normal sci-fi show, because we just have known the whole time that it's this weird one-off thing, and we know that it's only 17 episodes. And I think having that knowledge leads you into this episode expecting like, okay, you're going to do some kind of wacky allegorical thing that's not going to answer any of our questions. And so because I like was expecting that, I had a very similar feeling to you of like, okay, yeah, that you did it. You paid off at least thematically the things that have been built up during the show. And it does, I agree, feel like an answer to the question of how do you end The Prisoner instead of, I don't know, like it sort of exists a little bit separate from the rest of the show in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it's hard to have full empathy because of that for people who were like tuning in the '60s. And I was reading a lot of context and different interpretations of the episode, but on the Prisoner Wiki, it makes the point of, you know, in England at the time there were three channels
and yeah,
there were like, whatever, over 10 million or 15 million, I don't know how many people watching the episode when it happens. And so this is like an event, more so than it is for us, another thing that we're kind of just chewing through and observing. So I think if I experienced it in that context, I don't know what I would have thought about it. But I think I had been properly calibrated to not expect very much in the way of question answering. Because there are no questions that are answered, right? and if anything, there are certain questions that are given just like a big middle finger by the episode.
Straight up.
The first one that comes to mind is the question of where is the island? And the fact that they get in a truck and drive from the island to London is like, wait a minute. Come on. I thought this was in the ocean.
I thought we talked about like it's an island off the like far off the coast, like of
Spain. Yeah, we literally flew over it in a helicopter. We saw it, remember? and then the show's just like, yeah, fuck it though. It's just right down the street. That's where it is. So there are a few things like that in this episode that I think, can be jarring and off-putting in certain ways, but overall, I think it's the right ending for the show. You know, I can't think of any ending that even remotely is grounded in reality that would have worked. It has to be this like wacky, dreamy,
kind of cyclical thing.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I guess I'm also a sucker for cyclical endings, because you can definitely read the moment where number six and Angela Mascott walk back into his house as like the show wrapping back around to the intro and being like, and now he's going to be sick of this again, and then he's going to leave again. He's going to resign from whatever he's doing in life again, and it'll just still go back to the village. But it's not as clean as like other cyclical shows. Like, it's obviously literally recreating a shot but adding a couple of elements to it, but it doesn't feel as like neat and tidy as like, yep, this is going to happen again, you know, this, like, it's so much more up to interpretation. And again, I really respect that. Especially like learning more about Magooan and the historical context behind this. But for now, we can talk about sort of the beat to beat of this episode.
Let's get into that.
So it starts with a surprisingly long and ultimately really useless recap of, I guess, everything that's important plot-wise that's happened in the last episode, or and as well as Arrival, because it's like, okay, Six on island, people hate him, he feels trapped, he tried to escape, he couldn't escape, and then number two, and then acted like a baby, lived through all of life, number two dies,
but he's going to be number one. It ultimately has no bearing on this episode, I feel like.
No, yeah.
I feel like they're sort of different. In a way, you could have almost ended the prisoner at the end of the previous episode in some ways.
Yeah, that's a different ending, right? It's like you get to meet number one. Okay, great. Good luck. You keep fighting.
Yeah, the end. And so this is sort of another, you could think of it as like an additional ending, or just sort of a branch in a different direction to answer the question of like, how does a person become a fully fledged and fully realized individual? And is that possible?
Yeah.
So like recapping the previous episode, it felt like, hey, check it out, when we did this World War II thing where we were like, meow, so fun to play pretend together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And as Six is brought into number one's lair, which I described in my notes as looking like a level in like Just Cause or something. Uh-huh. Like,
yeah,
literally we're on an island and there's a bunker under the island. Or like John and I recently were getting back into Fortnite and like all the agency island stuff. We were just like, what? How did they build this? Why is this here? There's like a hangar and all of these like employees doing who God knows what. Like, there's a whole thing. It's not surprising that there's a whole underground layer, but
it felt very in similar ways to The Girl Who Was Death. It felt very Bondy.
Yes.
And I saw in the trivia that actually they for budget purposes, they reused some of the sets from The Girl Who Was Death.
Right.
Like the rocket control room was just the same set from that episode. So,
which sometimes you can catch them on that. You can kind of see it.
Yeah.
That's the same.
Right.
But we're repurposing it with all these employees and a sign that says, welcome, which is well space come, which I love. We haven't seen good signage on the prisoner really since it's been a while. I don't think it's necessary. Like, Arrival had the best signage easily, but you know. The prisoner always has good signs. And there's all these men and or people in white cloaks and black and white masks with titles in front of them as if they're in a court with titles like welfare, pacifists, activists, socialists. Mm-hmm. It's like I was really struggling to figure out what was the connecting thread between all of those titles. Is it just like government or society, maybe? Because pacifists and activists are not obviously terms of titles of government. They are just positions in revolution.
I wonder, you know, there are a couple interpretations that we can get into once we lay out the details, but I think the way that I kind of read that was like was sort of making a mockery of how ideological labels and differences ultimately don't amount to much substantive difference in our society. Mm-hmm. Like, you calling yourself a nationalist versus a communist, whatever, ultimately, like, the post-imperial nation state capitalist monstrosity is gonna churn on and do what it's gonna do. And we're all sort of like part of the pageantry of that happening, because we're not like substantially resisting what's going on.
And some of these people do resist, or some of like we see Six and the other three rebels are the people who are resisting.
Mm-hmm.
So he descends into this lair with all these people. Worth noting also, really threw me for a loop that he walked by a jukebox that was playing All You Need Is Love by the Beatles.
He walked past like five jukeboxes.
Yeah. That song you said came out like in 67. So
yeah, it'd be like if you made The Prisoner Now and oh my God, wait, with the Justin Bieber song.
Yeah.
Yummy. Ooh, you got that yummy, yum, right? Imagine if that was...
Yes, song. Or like, just shows do this now. Like, you know, it felt like it weirdly reminded me of like CW shows where they're like very, very timely licensed music plays as this person comes
in.
Yeah,
over the like dramatic slow motion scene or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Or like the dance scene, yeah. And he goes in and he's brought forth to the judge, who is trying to determine what his what the instating of his position is going to be as the new leader of the village, because now the number two is dead, presumably. You know, we have to take care of humanity and we have to put number six on his throne. So he's placed on a big blue throne on a dais, and we have him being shaved and prepared for a court trial. And we're presented with basically some examples of revolt of different people who have revolutionary types on the island one by one, so that Six can kind of see examples of like what he has succeeded over against other people who've tried to do this. Is that accurate so far?
Yeah, that's right so far. And so we get two characters representing different forms of revolt or rebellion, with the setup being that Six is kind of the third example and is framed as like the successful example. The first is number 48, who I wouldn't have realized this if I hadn't read background information, but it's the actor from Living in Harmony.
But not the kid.
But not the same character, right?
Well, the kid's dead, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. But number two is dead, too. So.
True. Death doesn't mean anything on the island.
Yeah. But that was such a strange choice to me, to cast the same guy, but he's a different character. I don't know.
Well,
I felt that was odd.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the show, what I like, one of the things I like about it is that it, like, doesn't, it kind of... spits in the face a little bit of like the attempt to overanalyze it, because it's like, no, it doesn't, like, it's possible that it was just because they didn't have a lot of other young men on the cast, and they want you to be like, wait, do I know you? What were you doing before? Why are you here? And just that confusion is more rewarding than being like, well, we got a new guy and you'd have no attachment to him, because there was no other like young man on the show so far.
I mean, I guess
it's been like number twos and number ones and not whatever, like number 11s and stuff. I don't know.
I guess his character here sort of rhymes with his character from the other episode, but
yeah,
but then why not just make it the same guy? You know, like if number two is the same guy, why not just, I don't know. It seemed, I guess when we talk about the documentary, we'll talk about how like confusing people was definitely one of Patrick McGoohan's main goals. So
primary, yeah, objectives.
I think maybe your read is correct because of that. But I found it distracting that it was the same guy but a different character,
and a fairly similar performance, because he's kind of going Looney Tunes. He's going Looney Tunes on this court, and they're talking about how they have to. There's like different rebellious voices in society, but in times of crisis, we have to quell the rebellious voices that threaten to tear us apart, is the gist of what number one, or not number one, what the judge is saying about this 48 guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets out of his like little court cylinder and starts like running around singing various songs like a little child, and like yelling and hitting people and just being a cartoon man.
Yeah.
Very silly and weird, calling the judge dad, and then number six start calling the judge
thanks,
dad.
Thanks, daddy.
Thanks, daddy. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And the court starts yelling about stuff, like they're all yelling take, 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 which is really fun. It's one of those things where, again, I have to be like, does this mean anything? Are we just having fun with the court? And then we are then brought the second rebel, who is Leo McKern's number two, is just right back. They literally they say resuscitate, and then they just show the scene of him dying and reverse the footage.
yeah,
fantastic. Fantastic. Because then it's like,
they have to shave him because it's been a year since they produced that episode and he had shaved in the intervening time.
Right. So they need to justify that. Yeah. And he comes out, and Leo McKern continued to bring just a stellar performance, like very much
fantastic.
It's all in the eyes, right? He's talking like, I feel a new man, and like is yelling, and at first is very happy to be back and ready to serve, but he sees his own death and gets confused and angry. Like, why did you guys let me die? What killed me? Was it the drink? Like, what was it? And then what he realizes is that number one has been in this room the whole time, or at least the sort of watchful eye of number one.
Yeah.
Which is represented as a camera with basically eyelids on a big metal cylinder. And he looks at the camera and he says, you're not going to control me anymore. I don't want to work for you anymore. And he spits in the camera eye,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes it puke out smoke. That makes him nauseated. And he's taken away because he's a bad boy. It's kind of representing, I think it's simple to say, the adult revolutionary, like the person who tried and failed.
Yeah, the person who comes to revolution too late, like leaves it too early and comes back too late.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how can you possibly finish this now if you're already this late in life?
Yeah.
And then they say, we have a third revolutionary. It's you, number six. And this is why when we get to the number one reveal, I was already like, because I had guessed this before. We'll talk about that. But once they're like, also, you're the revolutionary that we're here to talk about, I'm already thinking, okay, we are centering this episode on number six's personhood. He has to matter to this village more than just being the rebel. And they show footage of his house being sold and like people changing up his car. And it's kind of like you were replaced there and now you're here.
Yeah.
And he starts getting very petulant. They start asking him all these questions and he only knows how to answer. And he starts asking them stuff, but he falls into the classic like 3-year-old trick of asking why over and over again.
Uh-huh.
The 3-letter word that killed the general. Like they're telling him like, oh, you came here because of this. And he's like, why? He's mm-hmm. very playful with it, which I love. And then he's given his sort of like, you would know what you normally say, like the bio or RPG choice, but it's also because this episode's called Fallout. I was thinking of like the end of a Fallout game it's like, do you want to leave the island? We'll give you like a bunch of money and we'll give you a passport that lets you live anywhere mm-hmm. and we will give you all the stuff. Or do you want to lead us and fix the village? It's sort of the core like question.
Yeah, it's this moment is it's a hard one to read, I think, because they're obviously not giving him a real choice. They're not actually saying you get to go. And he knows that. Because they say, you're free to go? And he says, free to go. And they say, anywhere. And he says, why? Why all of a sudden is this when it happens? Yeah. And then he says, I'm an individual. And the guy says, you are on your own. And Six says, I fail to see. And then the guy says, all about you is yours. We concede. So there's this kind of like, okay, I guess it's over. But Six is still willing to play their game a little bit and still having fun with it. And so they say, well, say a few words. And he clearly goes up with this like speech prepared.
Yeah.
And then all of the juror parliamentary dudes just shout over him when he tries to talk.
In agreement, which is hilarious.
Yeah. Which is kind of the... It's kind of like the ultimate failure of his brand of individualism, I think, that it is inherently prideful and that he does ultimately step up to seek the approval of the masses and then gets burned. And essentially his individualism in that moment, it's a mockery is made of it. So I think it's a tough moment to read in that respect. Cause also I this was noted to me in something I read. I don't remember where. But he doesn't speak for the rest of the episode after that moment.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I guess that makes sense.
But that happens. And then after that point,
this is where the episode gets very weird.
The episode gets wacky, yeah. We kind of get into the home stretch. They say that they'll let Six go to number one. He climbs up this, like, stairs thing. He sees a table full of globes, and it's like, oh my God, the globes are all turned in slightly different directions. Then there's a robed figure who's got a number one, and then he's watching the prisoner on TV, and he's also watching it in his little globe in his hand.
And, yeah, I mean, that's like when I have my iPhone while I'm watching TV shows on Netflix. Like, it's just, he's doing that.
Right.
He's multitasking.
And then he hands the little see-through globe to number six as if to say, like, you're in charge now, buddy. Number six drops it. And then the clip, we're hearing the word I from I refuse to be debriefed, reefed, and stamped and numbered or whatever.
This is the moment, yeah.
Yeah, all, and it like goes, I, and then he pulls off the dude's mask, number one's mask. And during that I thing, there's a shot on the number one. And it's like, oh, a visual pun almost. Because
right.
The number one looks like the letter
something
I.
Something
the
letter I, yeah.
So he pulls off the black and white mask. And there's an ape underneath, which means something. And then
sure.
He pulls off that mask. And it's him underneath, which
I was
means
right.
Something else. You were right. You did that thing that you do sometimes where you exactly predict something. And I don't know if it's a real prediction. Was that you didn't know?
It's possible. I don't like have a specific memory of knowing that at some point. But it's possible I knew it. Very long ago.
I spoiled it for myself pretty early.
You had? No, not recently. Watching. In watching this, I had not re-spoiled that for myself.
Gotcha.
but yeah, that's him under the cloak, which, I mean, this is like the moment that caused all the controversy was, I think, a lot of the... It's this and also the whole, like, you can leave if you want. Because a lot of people at the time, apparently, from my reading, were like, if he could have left whenever he wanted, and if he was number one, why didn't he leave? And it's like, you guys missed the point. You missed the whole show.
Right.
Because him being number one, he's like, screw this. And he decides it's time to escape. So he jumps down and starts fighting a bunch of dudes. And the Lord himself comes down, Angelo Mascot. And the two of them have their own little fun action scene where they shoot their way through the bunker. And we rescue number 48 and number 2 as well. Yeah. And we're doing a full gunfight where they're blasting people.
Love. Yeah.
This is, I mean, this is
silly
like
silly stuff.
Some like Boondock Saints, like, or whatever, modern movie, like gunfight set to nice music thing. That's such a trope. And it's weird to see it in a 1960s TV series, 1960s show. But Angelo Mascot with machine gun is just, it's the visual that I've been looking for. Since the minute I saw his face, is him just gunning people down.
Yeah. Yep. 100%.
And then like some high-pitched voice starts talking. And then a lot happens at once. This is where it gets kind of like very impressionist. And I'm curious what you think the next couple of scenes are saying.
Yeah.
Because the rover, we can tell, definitely the rover is shut down. What happens is the rover.
Yeah, the rocket shoots into space. There's a song that's like, I like you a lot or something. The rover shrivels up. In like this crazy looking stop motion shot.
Hell yeah.
They just drive. Angelo Mascot is driving us out on the jail car. And then we just have a little road trip and like wave at a guy in his car and dance.
He does a double take and we're dancing. We have tea.
They let number 48 off on the side of the road so he can hitchhike or whatever. They let number 2 out at a government building so he can get a cool job. And then it's like then number 6 and Angelo Mascot go home and Angelo Mascot is his butler now.
There's some incredible shots in here. I think the space thing, initially I thought that I really did think that like, are number 6 and the rebels going to space? Please give me this. And what I think it actually is just that the village is retreating. Because the like loudspeaker comes on and says, like, everybody evacuate immediately. They all go outside, they all get out, and they're driving away. And then we see the, like, you can really just intuit this from shot continuity, but the ship then leaving suggested to me that the village, their emergency escape plan was to go to space. Why? Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. They're leaving. They're done. They have no longer, the village no longer serves a purpose.
Yeah.
And yeah, them like taking the Rebel Squad truck out, and I'm just, and like the sheer cartoonishness of the guy looking at them and doing a double take, like, wait, there's men in that truck? Mm-hmm. It's so goofy.
Yeah. There's a lot about this finale that's goofy, which I appreciated.
Yeah, I would say it's almost exactly like 50% comedy. It's really good.
Yeah.
And that's important, too, because, you know, I've written about the, like, role of comedy on The Prisoner, but I think what's so important is once they've gotten out, you need the comedy is the way that you know that this isn't fake for once. Like this is their real escape because it's funny. It's not like there's a sense of dread or like he's gonna walk into another perilous situation.
But there's evidence that they're not out.
Yeah, the evidence being like the whole loop thing, or that they're not where think they are.
His apartment door opens automatically.
Right.
Yeah, and the shot he's driving the same route as from the beginning of the show.
But I mean, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the, like, whether or not the ending feels triumphant. But the other amazing shot, once we're back in London, I think we both noted that this is, like, one of the best shots of the series, probably. We have number six briefly, like, talking to a police officer. I guess, I don't know, asking him something, but he's very excited. He, like, jumps in the air when the cop leaves.
Yeah.
But it's filmed from behind Angela
and
Scott watching it.
My favorite shot of the whole show.
It's unbelievable. The power of the cinematography here to just convey, like, I don't know, I read it as like him going like, fuck, life is happening. Like, oh my God, like this is real. And like him accepting it and just, but like passively observing all of this and watching this man's joy and like realizing his position in life. Like you learn so much about the butler in this shot, this like simple steady shot of him watching number six, and it feels like you feel emotional even though nothing, he's not doing anything other than just standing still. Like it works better than any line he could have ever gotten or like action scene.
Right.
And yeah, he goes back to the house with number six, and the car has been repainted. It's like a different, it's not yellow anymore, it's got like black and red on it. And that's where we're at. And then, yeah, the door opens automatically. So it's kind of like, oh, is this just going to happen again? Uh-oh. Mm. How did you feel before you started reading about it? How did this finale make you feel? Because I think the most important thing about this finale is that it makes you feel things.
I was trying to pick apart what exactly is instructive about it. Like if I think the way that I've been approaching The Prisoner is kind of as a historian and someone who's interested in revolutionary movements and what makes them succeed or fail. And so for me, the part that was the most telling was the whole like court parliament part of it. And then there is the kind of like, you know, personal aspect to The Prisoner that I, with him being number one, it's like, okay, who else could it be? But also, does that mean anything to me? I didn't really get a lot of personal meaning out of that right away. And then the ending, it's sort of like, yeah, this is like a happy ride off into the sunset ending, but we're still trapped, which also felt right for the show, but also didn't mean much to me either. So I don't know. Once it ended, I was like, oh, okay, it's over.
Yeah.
I got stuff from it and now it's done. But yeah, I think in that respect, like once the shooting starts, the episode loses a lot of significance for me. Yeah.
It's very silly from there on out.
Right. What was your sort of take?
I think purely emotional, purely like not considering plot or anything, I was really ecstatic at the end. I felt really like warm and happy and felt like this is where this needed to go, you know. I've talked a lot about other shows I like that end well, like Lost, of course, which can't stop bringing up because of how much it has borrowed from The Prisoner liberally. But just this idea that like people were annoyed that both Lost and The Prisoner didn't answer questions. And so maybe 10 years ago when Lost ended, I was trained to not expect my shows to like give me answers like that. I know plenty of shows do, and plenty of shows can drip feed that out over a longer run. But when you walk into The Prisoner and you go into it and you know it's 17 episodes, you're not going to expect like deep meditation on like the true nature of like what is the Rover, or like why does the village work the way it does. Like, you just don't have the time for that. It has to be more
impressive. Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, you can watch a show that's a story and there are shows that are allegories, right? Like B5, when we watch Babylon 5, that's a show that has an ending and all stuff happens and questions are answered because it's a story. But with this, or with Lost, it's like they're more allegorical. It's more abstracted. And so in that sense, it and I think maybe people mistook Lost for a show that had like answers and story. This show certainly is not that. And so in that way, like I wasn't frustrated by this episode by any means. I think it's just sort of like the way that it sometimes feels when you get to the end of a book and you're like, oh, okay, that's the last line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's challenging that way.
Yeah. I think the most significant thing for me that I got from it was this idea of like, of the society choosing Six's form of resistance as the right form of resistance and what implications that has for like real life revolutions.
Yeah.
Because you see Six overseeing number 48's form of rebellion, which is like, it's undisciplined, it's just random, and he's sort of looking down on that as incorrect and has a more dignified air. He's very comfortable in the throne. He's very comfortable taking the stage and sharing a few words with everybody. And so in a way, it kind of shows the flaws of like forms of resistance that are not entirely discontent with the status quo, and or just are willing to kind of accommodate and modulate towards the status quo, and how movements like that can actually end up not changing things, or change things in some ways but are undone, or a lot of the time can end up being co-opted by the status quo as a sort of like emblem of what makes the status quo good, almost.
Yeah, I mean, that's what 1984 is about in a lot of ways, right?
Right. Yeah, and I was thinking about like, like, you think about how Donald Trump will say Happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day kind of thing.
Right.
It's like that, where the society's like, hey, you did it, Six. You are the right kind of rebel, and so we approve of you.
You're the type of rebel that we can appropriate and put a face on.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, there's, like, infinite examples of that, both in history and in television, of the person who's not who's trying to make change, their message and their concept being co-opted by the state. I think that's part of the tragedy of this episode, is where it starts at, is that the village has the audacity to be like, you did it, you beat us.
Yeah.
And now you can be our face because it's you. You were always the face.
Right.
Like, I think the sort of fruitless endeavor is attempting to understand how number Six could be number one throughout the series. Like, is he guiding himself?
Right. It's not really literal in that way.
That scene doesn't feel literal. Like, it has the air of like a dream sequence or something.
Yeah.
But you know, the rest of the episode is kind of positing that, like, you know, maybe we are going to let you go so that you can start the loop again, because you getting out is how we get you back in. It's entirely cyclical, and when you're never truly out of the state.
Yeah. I mean, and it also, I think what is communicated about him being number one is all along the way, the thing that the village was trying to do was to break him, to get him to choose to be a part of their system. And I think ultimately what's being said there is like, the final way that the system can break you is by making you feel that you are in control of the system. Right.
Right. You like, are the system.
If you are someone who's like down on their luck and fighting economic inequality and then you win the lottery, you're going to start acting like a super rich person because now you sort of have the reins of power. And I think it makes sense in that way, as opposed to it literally having been him the whole time. Because we also saw earlier in the show that the village has the power to make clones of him. And maybe they just did that. They just made a clone of him and put him in a number one robe just to like fuck with Six one last time.
One more time. Because
why not? Yeah.
This is the thing, is we talk about this stuff and I just feel like I've seen that reveal before. This is a very well-handled, appropriate way to do that. But, and I do think that this show is brilliant, but like I feel like I understand and don't find the ending of the show to be that ambiguous, honestly.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it feels unambiguous because we've seen enough that trope occur enough times that we're like, yeah, of course it's him. But what's ambiguous about it is like, why? Why is that a trope?
Yeah.
What are you trying to say with that? Yeah.
And the whole like we're gonna let you leave so that you can come back just feels like it feels very appropriate because you don't get this show with a true like he's out, he escaped. We get to see him marry someone and live a life. It's one of the things I'm really worried about the remake doing. Is like if that six episodes and it has an ending, like what do you guys even attempt to do with this? And I'm sure they're going to whiff it in an interesting way, and we're going to find out next time. But like in the context of this show, another thing I always remember is like 1968, maybe people hadn't seen that plot twist very often.
Right, right.
So it's so much less common that you have to watch it and be like, wait, no, that doesn't work, actually. No, I'm not going to accept that. I'm actually annoyed by that.
Yeah.
And I want you to specifically, like, Patrick McGoohan was being asked and hounded by, like, reporters and fans to be like, please tell me what this meant. And he hates that. And I would hate that as a creator. Like, you guys can figure it out. You're smart. You've read books before. You're adults. Like, what do you think happened at the end of The Prisoner? Do you think he got out? Do you think it's a time loop? Do you think it's a continuous loop? Like, what is your interpretation? Because me telling you is cheapening it, if anything.
That context kind of reminds me of how dogged the village is in asking him why he resigned and how the answer really isn't anything that significant. The answer is, I didn't want to be a spy anymore. And so if people are like, why is Six number one? It's like, because we're prisoners of our own design. Like, that's something that he's said in an interview. And it's like, oh, okay.
All right.
Yeah. But why?
But like,
I just told you. So you can either choose for that to mean something to you or it doesn't. And that's it.
Yeah. And I think that context, it makes so much sense and like gives the show its cult status. Is besides being an incredible, really consistent work, it also inspired a lot of thought and a debate, which I think is a success.
Yeah,
like if a show can get people to be this mad and to feel this much, it's like I said earlier, the episode succeeds because it made me feel things. Then ultimately, the show is good.
Right.
It worked out. What else within the scope of this episode before we kind of broaden the spectrum did you want to mention or pay lip service to briefly?
I can kind of skim through my notes here. So there's a couple things that I just thought were funny. I'm trying to remember. Well, I thought this was worth talking about. That the judge mentions that number 48 refuses to observe, wear, or respond to his number. And then also the moment where number 2 forcefully rips his number off. And just the fact that 6 has like earned the ability to not be called by a number anymore. I think that continues to speak to how, at the end of the day, society is still making the choice of like who goes by a number and who doesn't. There's something to be said for that. I think that
right. All these titles are artificial, and you could take it off whenever you want. No one's making you do it, but you give yourself that ability.
Right. I liked when Six reached out to shake hands with number two in like a kind of a respectful way, like, hey, how's it going, buddy?
That was good cute. Solidarity moment, honestly. Yeah. Yep.
Number two says, what is deplorable is that I resisted for so short a time.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah, I'm trying to see if there's anything else that I wrote from the content of the episode before I get into some interpretations that I found.
Yeah.
Which I think I can just do now. So the main interpretation I found was there's that prisoner fan site that I mentioned a few episodes ago, prisoner.gigacorp.net. And they have a whole page called the Fallout Theory. And the Fallout Theory really just amounts to essentially what they're saying is that this episode is really kind of a meta commentary on Patrick McGoohan himself and his career.
Yeah.
And his sort of not wanting to be a spy actor anymore and not wanting to be typecast anymore. And so each of the different figures represent something in the real world. Number six is Patrick McGoohan himself. The robed figures are the members of the public. The president is perhaps like a, you know, a producer of some kind. Number two and number 48, they don't fit as neatly into this read, I don't think. Neither does the butler.
Yeah.
And number one is maybe you could say like people's desire to idolize Patty McGee and to have him be their like their leader or this particular image that they want and how sort of twisted that is. And maybe in that sense, the ape mask is sort of like you're the dancing monkey almost.
Yeah, perform for us, be the spy that we want.
Yeah, so I think that that's a read that you can make. I'm not compelled by it as like the definitive read of the episode, but I do think that there's, especially after watching the documentary, which we'll get into, there's quite a lot to be said about the autobiographical lens that you can take on the prisoner.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, this episode feels like it should be at least looked at in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also really telling that this script was thrown together within a 48-hour period and produced so long after the episode before and not conceived of as, but maybe it was like sort of conceived of as one of the original seven. I can't remember actually. But it really feels like Patty McGee is interpreting his own show a little bit in this episode. And that's why it kind of feels like of a different piece from the rest, because the rest feels like this kind of serial sci-fi exploration of this dude is on this island. And then this episode is like, okay, and now Patrick McGoohan, here's how I would end it. Here's what I think the major themes are. Here's the parts that I actually don't give a shit about. And so I'm going to shoot them into space or just drive away from them in a big truck. So yeah, I don't know. That's the read. We can link it because I think it's worth looking at. But I don't see it as the sort of like end all be all interpretation of the episode.
Yes. Yeah. I'll link that in the notes for sure.
Yeah. I can sort of summarize some other stuff that I came across in other sources. So the AV Club review doesn't really gesture that much at an interpretation, which I found kind of odd. I think it mostly is summary and then kind of says what I was basically saying before, which is that the village stays in power by embracing what it cannot destroy. It changes the entire conflict and threatens to nullify Six's supposed victory, like the hip language the judge adopts to converse with 48, or the brutal tactics with which it can't entirely stop McKern from laughing. The group can assimilate and it can browbeat, but it never learns. It is old and it is clever, but it is not wise. When Six tries to give his speech, no one listens because it is easier to cheer. Before, Six could resist them because they wanted something from him that he could hold back, but now that they've surrendered, they've made his resistance a moot point. So I think that's like the most useful part of the AV Club review, which really just sort of agrees with some stuff that I was saying before.
Right. Otherwise, it's less of a read and more of a traditional critical review.
Yeah. And then let's see. There's some stuff in the wiki. We can get to McGowan's own interpretation when we talk about the documentary. So there's some quotes actually from the documentary that we'll sort of save. Number 48 stuff is a little weird. The actor wrote some of his own lines because Patrick McGowan was too busy to do it. The judge guy is also someone who was in a previous episode playing another character. He was the dad in Girl Who Was Death.
Oh.
Yeah, which I didn't notice. Something that I found funny was some people were mad about the finale in part because they just missed the shot where Six is number one because it's so short. It's only like a couple seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine you're watching this in the 60s where you have like no way of recording anything and it's not going to get rerun. So it's like, oh, I was looking the other way and I missed it. What right. happened?
Right, right, right.
Yeah. But that's it. And then there's some info in the wiki about like sequels. And there was like a sequel novel and a sequel comic book, both of which try to write this episode off as if it's some kind of hallucination or something,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a cheap way to do it. But yeah, that's basically it for Fallout.
Damn.
Yeah.
It's a dense one. There's a lot of reads.
Yeah.
But again, I think the one I mostly support and feel most agreed with is just the political, like, you know, you can't escape the state kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more straightforward than I expected, but the like symbolic journey that we take to get here was so fun and so like rewarding to get through.
Yeah.
But that's what we have for Fallout specifically, and that covers all of the episodes of The Prisoner. But we will, for now, take a brief musical break, and we'll be back to discuss the 2017 documentary, In My Mind. Welcome back to Prisoner Chats. The second piece of prisoner-related media we watched this week was the 2017 documentary In My Mind. In My Mind was written and directed by Chris Rodley, and it was originally released on October 30th, 2017. Magellan, how did we find this thing? I think it was on Amazon.
Amazon suggestions. Like, if you like this, you'll also like a documentary about it. Which... You got me, Amazon.
You did it.
You are correct.
I wish every chat show had a full documentary.
Honestly,
about
it. Yeah, having the experience of last weekend watching the Dana Carvey show and the documentary, and then now watching The Prisoner and the documentary, I wish every show, after you finish it, could be like, by the way, this is all the problems that happened on the way to creating this thing.
And I think... the two main things to talk about it are like this documentary as a work and where it, what it does right and what it doesn't do right. And then mm-hmm. also what we learn from
the
interviews
with
McGowan.
Information in it. I think we can start with the documentary as a documentary because my thoughts on that are pretty brief and
it's
mostly
stinks.
Negative. It's not good. I tried to look up Chris Rodley just now before we started recording to see if there's anything of his that people might know. And it just looks like it's a lot of documentaries, like TV documentaries about music or about different artists, or a lot of documentaries about like how things got made.
Yeah.
So that this seems in line with that body of work. But overall, I think the craft of this documentary was mostly cheesy. And I don't know, like, I understand the technical limitations of documentary, and I understand that often you have to sort of intercut like clips from the show with this interview we found with this other thing with like weird drone footage, and yeah, that's just how documentaries work. But I've seen others do that to greater effect and to more artistic effect, and this just felt, I don't know, it felt like pretty loosely stitched together, and like it ultimately wasn't really saying much. I think it thought it was saying more than it was.
Yeah, it made me think about like what are the essential truths that documentaries are seeking to get at. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of work that even discusses that. Like, there are documentaries about making documentaries, and there are, you know, quick classic example, Lost in La Mancha, where like the production of the documentary and the work that it's about is the center of the story. There are documentaries that are fictional. You know, this is a very broad kind of genre of of filmmaking. But what I think most significantly this documentary in my mind doesn't succeed in is like, I don't feel like I learned huge, like big truths about the prisoner. And I also don't know what I was looking for, if that was what I wanted.
Right.
Because
I think
they got Patrick McGoohan to sit down in his house and talk to them. Like, they literally got the gold standard of like what you want out of this. And I still came out of it like, I mean,
so I can sort of give the overview of like what this documentary consists of. So if people either didn't watch it or don't want to, they have a sense of it. Essentially, from what I've gathered from the documentary, it was made in 2017, but actually a few decades earlier, this same documentarian had done an interview with Patrick McGoohan and put it together as a documentary that went on television. And now, later in life, he has these misgivings about how that turned out and thinks that it wasn't very good. And is taking a second stab at creating a documentary that like sets things right. I wish that there was a way to find and watch that original one, because I don't fully understand what was wrong with it. There's a moment in the documentary where they're like, yeah, it'd be too painful to watch this original, so we're not going to watch it. And it's like, but that's central to the narrative of the film you are making now.
Yeah.
Is helping me to understand why the thing you made before was bad, and you don't do it. So
for what it's worth, by the way, 6 into 1, The Prisoner File, the documentary that you're referring to, is on YouTube.
It's on YouTube?
Fully, yes.
How long is it?
54 minutes long.
I might watch it. No, yeah. I don't know.
I would at least take a peek at it just to see what footage is used from that and what stuff is excised. Because basically, yeah, I'll let you continue with your explanation of this documentary.
Well, now I'm opening it up.
Okay, well, I'll continue the description of the documentary. Basically, they were unhappy with 6 Into 1, The Prisoner File, and there was a ton of footage that Patrick McGoohan didn't want used out of that. He actually tried... It's basically writing a blank check to Rodley, being let me have all the footage. I'm going to destroy it. I'm going to make a documentary about myself, which like crazy, really weird, really, really wild to hear Patrick McGoohan and to hear Rodley describe McGoohan as someone who is like not only very unsatisfied with his own work, but or with his own performance, I guess, in the documentary, but like.
Yeah.
To the point where he was like, I'm going to recut it and like score it, and I'm going to air that, and then I'm going to sell that, and that's what's going to be the documentary about the prisoner. You guys don't get to make it.
Yeah, the whole narrative was so fascinating and fun.
It's like a third act twist in a documentary.
But also it did feel, I think with all documentary has to grapple with this inherent contradiction that like... stories that are very personal are really engaging, but also are inherently manipulative. Mm-hmm. And I think to a certain extent, this documentary manipulates and takes advantage of things that Patrick McGoohan didn't want people to see.
100%.
And so we get a window into him, but it feels invasive. And because essentially what we see is they meet with him to try to say, like, can we interview you? And he's like, only if I get to control who you talk to. And they're like, well, no. And he says, okay, no. And then he just leaves. And then they get another shot at it. And he's like, okay, cool. I rented this empty house. Or I own it, maybe, or something. He just has just access empty to an empty house.
Yeah.
And they interview him there. And they spend a whole day. And it's clear that they're like huge amateurs and they don't know what they're doing. Because the crew is like tired. And it's like, well, we're still shooting all day. And he's like having to direct them. Their initial shots look so terrible.
Yeah.
They're like across the table from him.
Like, that's one of the first frustrating things is like, you guys got the like magnanimous, important figure at the center of this like important piece of television, and you don't know how to make a documentary, and you're not confident enough to work it out.
Right. And he's like barely talked about the show. They also bring in some clips of him giving an interview on Canadian television in 1977. And that was like the only other big example of him doing something like this. Mm-hmm. So they totally botch it. And he has to like direct them through how to shoot him and what to ask him to get the answers out of him. And then he, like you said, comes to their hotel and is like, I'll pay you whatever you want to not release that footage. And let's do it again. And so they do it again. And then he doesn't like that either. So he sends them his own documentary where he had his daughter ask him the questions. And he's like, use this instead. And he basically just had her re-ask all the questions they asked.
Yeah.
And he gave like slightly more polished answers and interspersed cuts of him like drawing a clothes hanger on the beach.
It's
fucking hilarious.
His own soundtrack that he like found, like a woman singing folk music.
And they don't air it.
They don't have that either.
They lost the file. Like, that's the worst part of the whole thing. Where they're like, hey, Patrick McGoohan made his response documentary the way he wanted it to be. We don't know where the file is. We filmed it off of a TV when we watched it the first time, and then we totally misplaced it. And it's like, that is the thing I wanted to see.
Just give me that.
Out of this whole thing that you're doing, that's what I actually wanted to watch. So that's frustrating. And then they put theirs out. And this whole time, it's weaving that stuff through some of the other interviews they had done with his collaborators on the show, and also a modern interview with his daughter, which kind of excuses some of the manipulative stuff they're doing, I guess.
Kind of.
Because
Catherine McGoohan is one of the more interesting interview subjects in this.
Right.
Because she definitely has a lot of like reverence for her father, but also recognizes like, why are you guys making this? I'll answer your questions, but like, think about why you're making this, because she's clearly leading them on through all of her interviews being like, yeah. I mean, like, he felt this and he felt like he didn't want to answer questions about a show.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are asking him right now and you did 20 years ago. Maybe think about that next time. And it's just like this, that is the only time that the documentarian like doesn't put themselves into the film and talk about like, yeah, but we did it anyways because we wanted to know stuff. Like, on one hand, I wish we learned more about who these people making the documentary were. On the other hand, it's like, make them invisible, you know?
Right.
Either they have to be partly the subject of this story, or I don't want to know who they are. I don't want to see all this footage of the guy walking in front of camera.
There's this unwillingness, I think. It's the ultimate flaw of the documentary, that there's this unwillingness to be fully introspective.
Yes.
Because there's some gestures towards it, like, we messed up or he deserved better. But there's nothing specific about it in any sense. So I don't have an understanding of, like, if it was actually bad and if what you did was bad and if Patrick McGoohan was mad at you, how did people receive it? So, like, why are you making in 2017 this response to your own documentary that doesn't substantially respond to your own documentary?
Like, I know why you released it. It's because you hit the 50th anniversary, and like, there's nothing better to release for that right. occasion. But at some point, like, maybe consider just not releasing this, because I mean, ultimately, the stuff that I got at, like, the rewarding parts of it are the interviews with the rest of the crew and the last interview scenes with McGoohan out overlooking, I think it's like Santa Monica, where he's like, he taught us how to film him, and he taught us how to ask him questions. And now this is the part where we talk about the prisoner frankly and what he felt about the secret agent show and all of that stuff. Like, that's the documentary. Everything before that is like a rough draft of that.
Right.
In my opinion. And especially like to talk about the directing too, like, you had mentioned in your notes that you would almost prefer if this was an audio documentary, because the visual,
yeah, there's nothing to look at here.
The visual is a lot of like cutting to the show and just like nice HD scenes of the show, which mm-hmm. like look fine, but you know, they keep trying to make these really corny comparisons where they're like, and then we called him, and then they play like the phone ringing in one of the episodes.
I'm yeah, like, right. It's like a little dorky.
It's really dorky. It's just yeah. like, it gets in the way of like, just this guy is interesting enough. You don't have to put any artifice on this. He's a fascinating interview. He was a fascinating interview subject, and so is his daughter, and that's all you needed. Like,
right. Yeah, exactly. I would almost rather this was... It seems like the fix is just to show us the whole interview with Patrick McGoohan and like stop with the extra stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of fluff, especially in that 1980s interview. Like, one of the things that we kind of like learn about McGoohan is that despite being a kind of confident figure in Hollywood, he has a lot of like self-consciousness about his own like performance and body and way that he speaks, actually, mm-hmm. which I found so revealing, that like he was like a brilliant writer and like actor and knew how to perform in front of people, but when it comes to like being yourself, he's like, that sounded really weird and nerdy. Like, there's this part yeah. early on where they just are having him sit down and be like, just talk about this guy who like you worked with on the show, and he like mentions him and mentions a fun fact, and he goes, no, that was really silly, guys. Can we do that whole scene again? Like, mm-hmm. I'm sure that happens plenty with documentaries, is the subject being like, I didn't feel happy with that. Can we do that again? Because, you know, once the footage is captured, you are giving these documentarians the right to use all of it.
Yeah.
That's part of the agreement usually, or that you get final cut on it, which not everyone's going to give you. So he's like, actually, please let me give you the cut that makes me look good. But he's used to doing that in an acting context where you can just do takes, but they're just trying to get him to be a person, and they're not asking him to like give the perfect take. So
right, but he's just so hyper aware of how he comes off.
Yeah.
And he is used to tightly controlling that, because he tightly controlled the production of The Prisoner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found him as a person ultimately to be the most engaging part of the documentary, is just getting to know who he was, and also getting to know, it seems like Patrick McGoohan is someone who like really struggled with feeling like he was a hypocrite in a certain sense, because he is like trying to make this show about everybody should be independent thinkers and that's the theme, but then he is like controlling every aspect of the production and getting into fights with people, and he doesn't like it when actors talk about themselves because he thinks it's egotistical, but also he tries to make his own version of the documentary that gets it exactly right. Like, he really contradicts himself, because he's so committed to like his humility being very precisely engineered that it becomes egotistical. And I don't think that that is like, I don't think that he's being vain necessarily. I just think that he's so hyper aware of how he comes off to people that it's like constantly torturous for him.
And you know what sold that for me especially? In the back half of the documentary, we get these really revealing, amazing shots of the prisoner being filmed on the island of Port Marion, from the perspective of like a person who, like a tourist who just had a handheld camera and was like filming from other places, and they intercut those with the actual shots on the episode, like, and they sync up the dialogue, which is actually a good that directorial
was cool.
moment.
Yeah, that was cool.
And what I, you all, like, you know, when you like learn about how TV or films are produced, that there's like a ton of people on set. But since Port Marion had just finished being built and was like starting to blow up as a tourist spot when The Prisoner was being filmed, there are swaths of people watching, tourists, not even crew members, but tourists who are just like, ooh, a show is being filmed. I'm going to watch it like 3 feet out of frame. Like, when, as soon as you like pull away from where the camera was showing him in the episode, you realize that this whole series where this guy is like alone and figuring out his identity is just, being
like, looks like Disney World or something.
Exactly. Like he's a, he is, hey guys, like a monkey being asked to perform.
Right.
And that's the environment that he's used to, which explains in a lot of ways why, you know, 1980s Patrick McGoohan is like, I don't know how to just be a person in front of people. I know how to perform as a character, but not how to be a person.
Right.
Right. Very common thing, I think, amongst old, especially older Hollywood actors, but in general, like when we talk about actors being like they don't know how to act like normal people, it's because you're used to that,
right? And so it has to come out in the show. I think it's like a further evidence that this is autobiographical, because where else is he supposed to tell his real story and be his real self except right behind a very thin character mask?
Yeah, you know? And I don't want to like. And this is, the documentary asks us to do this, but I don't want to like try to dive too deep into like the psychology of Patrick McGoohan and what was his personal life about.
Right.
I think that's the fatal flaw of the documentary, is it asks us to be invasive. But I mean, he talks about growing up Catholic and being in a strict religious upbringing.
Gestures at like that sort of, and he's the one who brings that up, which I think makes it okay.
Yeah. And he's like, yeah, that like limiting environment that I grew up in and the like, the shackles of Christianity, as well as getting into television and finding my niche and then attempting to get out of it, and nobody wanted me to leave, that is where The Prisoner came from, is the sort of theory that this documentary posits and confirms what we read from that other blog, that like maybe the whole him leaving thing was about him leaving the secret agent show.
Yeah. And that, I think that was maybe the strongest bit of the documentary for me. Again, it's coming straight from him, of him sort of explaining like, this is the idea, the theme that has been dominating my life, and I just needed to put it out there somewhere. And I also was really moved by the footage of him in the televised play where he's like the priest.
Oh, it's so good.
So good. He's like the priest that's super convicted and essentially is him, right?
Yeah.
It's like a Henrik Ibsen play, or I don't remember the exact play, or the playwright, but that footage was really cool to see as
again.
Well,
don't need the bad documentary choice. I don't need his daughter being like, it's a really amazing performance, like you guys can show me it, I know it is, I'm watching it.
Right.
In the background, Catherine McGoohan's going, it's really good, you guys. I'm like, thanks appreciate that.
But yeah, it just made me think about like what you're seeing when you see The Prisoner is really, truly the one thing that this guy needed to do. You know, there's a reason that he didn't become a showrunner. Like, that's not who he is. He's not Aaron Sorkin, right?
He doesn't want to make all of his shows. He wanted to make a show.
He wanted to tell this story and send this message. And I think what's really admirable, at least again the way the documentary frames it, is just how determined he is to make the thing that he's trying to make. You know, he's got pages and pages outlining like the costumes and the props, describing all of the different pieces of the set. He's got ideas for different episodes going into it, so it's really his idea. And it made me also think about like television is an art form where you have to create by committee. And so TV shows, to be successful, I think have to strike a balance between, if you just create by committee, you're going to kind of wash out what's unique about the show. And if you have one person tightly controlling everything, then you're going to run into problems and it's just not possible for someone to do everything themselves. And so like, where in that spectrum do shows find success? Yeah. I think that in that way, this documentary tells an interesting story about that question and about Patrick McGoohan's approach to that question. So that's what I found the most engaging about it, I think.
And the last like big cool thing about this documentary is that we get, as we mentioned, really, I would say eye-opening clips of other people who worked on the show, including George Markstein, and some of the like writers and directors, mm-hmm. and him talking about like, oh, I didn't really know any of these writers, but like Markstein just hired a bunch of dudes and they like flash cut all 17 episodes writer credits in front of you. And he's like, none of these people mattered to me. I never knew any of these people. They just wrote scripts for me.
Well, no, but he says that they were good writers.
Yeah, he says they're all competent and good. He's just like that. Like this was not like we didn't like build this writers team together. Like I asked this guy to give me writers and he just kind of like
he brought in the squad.
Yeah.
And then it's funny when George Markstein is, I think that was him talking about the script for Fallout. And he's like, yeah, I mean, he's number one. Like, what else could it have been? It's obvious that that's where he was going. It's like, okay, dude, whatever.
Or the surprisingly common practice in Hollywood of, you know, McGoohan writing or directing certain episodes and then giving the script to someone and they're like, this sucks. Who wrote this? And they read it and it's like Archibald, whatever. And he's like, yeah, that guy's good. I'm telling you, he's good. You got to give him a script. Like, it's you give him a chance. And it's him. He just wrote a pseudonym. They're like, okay, I'll give Archibald a shot. And he's like, sweet, thanks. I mean, I'll tell Archibald you said thanks. The production of this show seems very, not seat of its pants, but like, it's the sum of a lot of weird aspects of television production.
Yeah.
You know, he discovered Port Marion while doing an episode of Danger Man. Like, they drove to Port Marion. There's a shot of him in that series driving through the center of the town. Mm-hmm. And he was like, that was the moment I knew that, like, I want to do something here. And we even, like, pay respects to, like, the guy who designed the village.
Yeah.
And they're like, this guy was brilliant. And there's, like, plenty of shots of McGoohan in the 60s talking to him and, like, being buddy-buddy with him, like, we asked him if we could film and he was okay with it. And, you know, it existed right around the same. It came into existence when our show started. So you kind of can't think about Port Marion without thinking of The Prisoner anymore. They're inexorably tied together. And we're really grateful for that because it's a beautiful sort of intersection of cultures, which I think works well
for the show. It's beautiful, but it's also like unsettling. Mm-hmm. Like Catherine McGoohan really drives this home. Where she says like her mom could enjoy a couple days there, but then after a couple days, it's like, this place is creepy. Get me out of here. And that was, I don't know, just, yeah, that idea of like, I found the perfect place. It like has all this beautiful sculpture and architecture. And because of how beautiful it is very unsettling.
Yes. Yes. It feels out of time in a way.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I got. I think all of the like production stuff is really fascinating. And again, the later clips of McGoohan, like when they actually figured out how to ask him questions, and he even says like, McGoohan told me that if I look him in the eye, he'll answer more honestly. And he totally did. And I'm like, fuck, you guys, you should have learned how to film a documentary. You had him for so long. This guy gave you hours of his life. And you were just like, I didn't even think to look him in the eye when I asked it. Like, I was just reading off a prompt. Like, what are you doing? It, like, makes me sad. But also, like, you got to make your first documentary somehow. Like, your first subject is going to, it's going to be awkward as hell. Like, that's okay.
True. Yeah.
But that's basically in my mind.
I think people should watch it just to have some of that extra backstory. And there are some gems from McGoohan's interviews. Like I loved the bit from the 1977 interview where he's like, we're run by the Pentagon, we're run by Madison Avenue, we're run by television. And then he's talking about how he had to like sign in and like go through security downstairs.
Yeah.
And he's like, that makes me mad. That makes me want to rebel. Chill out, dude.
It's just the way he is. He's not playing a character when he gets all intense like that. It's just the way he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. There were some other quotes that I thought were good, where he talks about, like, of course, you know, the villain at the end, the biggest villain of all, it's like what we do to ourselves.
Yeah, there
are some things to be said. And then I loved, I gotta say, even though it felt weird that they were using that footage he told them not to use, the part at the end where he is like across the room from them and clearly doesn't want to talk to them anymore and gives his final thoughts, and then he's like, and that's it, bye. And then he just turns the lights off and walks out and is gone. Awesome. So good.
So good.
So I just double checked my notes, and the line that Patrick McGoohan says before he turns the lights off is, I've done my best to confuse you. And then he is like, bye-bye. We also
I've done my best to confuse you, and then turning the lights off is the end of The Prisoner, by the way.
You're right.
Right.
We just took like a very brief secret break, by the way, that is impossible to notice because of editing magic.
So imperceptible.
I just watched the first 3.5 minutes of Six into One, the 1984 documentary, and it starts with this like actor being number two watching footage of The Prisoner and being like, why did you resign? And why did you create a show like The Prisoner? Fucking cheesy as hell. There's also like that they showed in the documentary, the like 80s graphics and synth music intro that looks so stupid.
Yeah, they talked about that. They're like, yeah, one of the biggest problems with it is that they like threw shitty 80s stuff on it, yeah, and instantly made it dated.
Right. Couple other things from the documentary before we sort of talk general thoughts on The Prisoner. Let's see if I can remember.
We already talked about the General Magellan.
Oh, you. I loved Lou Grade, the like head of whatever BBC or I don't know what.
Secret king of this documentary, Lou Grade, yeah, a.k.a. Lord Grade.
Yeah, Lord Grade. He was Lou Grade when I knew him. Oh, let's do it again. Let's take it again.
That's the part that he's like, that was corny. No.
Yeah. Patrick McGoohan is like, I told him about this thing. Maybe Lou Grade's telling this part of the story. I don't remember. But one of them is like, I said, Pat, you know, you see, it's so crazy, it might work. When do we start? And then they're like, how did you get along with Patrick McGoohan?
Best part.
And Lou Grade goes, how do you do it? I just give in to him. But it's cool. It's like he had total faith in Patrick McGoohan. And he's like, yeah, this dude was, he was hot to trot. He was the biggest star we could have had. So if he's going to make his own show, I don't care. Sounds good to
me. I'm not
going to
get in his way.
Do it. And I don't know. We didn't get much information about, like, I guess a lot of people watched it, right? So like it was successful. I don't know if in TV terms it was successful or not.
At the time, yeah, like, yeah, ratings wise. I think it did pretty well.
Yeah. We also saw some of this stuff about like the Danger Man thing, how after 39 episodes, McGoohan was sort of like, all right, we're done, right? So we're good.
Can we go? And they're like, no, we need to make a million of these.
Yeah, like we could do this forever. He's like, but we are done, right? And then it kind of, that sort of reframes, I think, this why did you resign thing.
Yeah.
As the prisoner being about, like, why did you stop being Danger Man? Why did you not become James Bond? What's wrong with you? Don't you want to do that? And he's like, no, I resigned.
He's like, spy shit is dumb. Yeah, like, I don't want to do spy shit.
I don't want to do it. He talks about how there was this scene in Danger Man that he essentially vetoed, where he would have been in bed with a sexy lady rolling on top of her to like open a safe or something. And he was like, I didn't want to do that. So we didn't do that scene.
It's fascinating. And maybe there's something like bigger than the scope of this podcast to discuss, that it's in his mind, it's because he was a practicing Catholic, I think, is the main reason. But this like resistance to spy fiction as like, what is the thing that they call it specifically? Like, it's like women and punching and drinking and all that stuff.
Kiss, kiss, bang, bang.
Thank you.
That's what they say.
The reason he doesn't like kiss, kiss, bang, bang is he's like, none of that stuff, I don't want people to like take that as a moral or like see that as cool. Like, that sucks. Those are bad qualities in people, which is it's a lot of ways kind of true.
Right.
But I think of it as like, Number Six is a cool character because he rejects a lot of the principles of masculinity, of like, you know, being overpowering over people, especially women. But I think for McGoohan, it's more like, no, like religiously, I feel weird about doing this. I don't really care.
Yeah, it seems like he just didn't really want to glorify killing or womanizing or whatever, which that's cool. Yeah.
I respect it.
Yeah, I respect it too. And that's maybe also the reason that he didn't want to be James Bond, because that's what Bond does.
There is a brief digression too about Leo McKern and the filming of the second to last episode.
Yeah.
That was another one where I was like, hey guys, honestly, maybe you shouldn't have filmed this. Maybe you shouldn't have put this in the documentary, because it makes me feel more uncomfortable about McGoohan's role in Leo McKern's nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. And granted, it's 1967, but basically the understanding is like, in our documentary, in my mind, we understand that this guy probably had like an actual anxiety attack or panic attack.
Yep.
But in that dumb 1970s Canadian interview that he just says like, oh, the guy was crazy. He was just like going off and he was having all sorts of problems. Like, kind of takes this like hoity-toity like superiority complex over the Canadian interview by being like, we know what that really was, but they didn't know back then. And so like McGoohan, maybe he was a bad guy. Like, it's just this weird like perspective of like,
you don't
get to talk about this. Like, I think the truth of it is they didn't have the terminology for what was going on with McKern mentally at that time.
Yeah, definitely not.
But to show the Canadian interview and to show McGoohan and be like, and then he was in a, like, I'm sorry, this is like upsetting for people, but this is like in the documentary.
Yeah.
Him being like, he was in a fetal position and asking us to stop, and we thought he was crazy, so we just kept doing it anyway. It's like, wow.
Right, it's fine.
Wow,
it's
I didn't fine. Need to know that.
Yeah.
It's a big bummer. That was why at first I was like, wow, this Canadian interview is like interesting, because like this guy's like giving him a cigarette or whatever, and they're just, it's like very laid back and fun, but it's also like two, you know, old dudes in the 70s being like, we have a lot of money and we're big successful.
Yeah, right. Sorry, I just had to kill a spider.
Congratulations. You were going to get powers though. You're in Brooklyn and you had a spider.
No, because what if it's a poison one?
Yeah.
I don't want it to be one of those poison spiders. Yeah, I felt like Leo McKern got the short end of the stick here.
100%.
In this, they were like, yeah, he was really good. Anyway, something happened with him, but turned out fine. Yeah.
Very sad.
That's pretty much all that I have on the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can sort of conclude with like just final thoughts about the prisoner overall, and maybe... are there, I don't know, our sort of thing of like best episodes, how should you watch it kind of thing?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of different orders that people suggest. Like if you go to the list of prisoner episodes on Wikipedia, there are multiple watch orders that you could use.
Right.
So that could be kind of how we approach it as well. I don't know. Do any of those?
I have.
What's up?
I have a seven episode like prisoner good episode cut. If you
okay,
want
cool.
It.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because McGoohan originally conceived of it as seven.
Yeah, and I can tell you definitively what I want those seven to be.
And I do think that it doesn't need to be 17, right?
No. Well, okay. It depends. When you understand like the show had to be sold to people, like yeah, at least 17, if not 21, whatever. But yeah, a lot of these are dumb and unnecessary and weird. And like, if you are watching The Prisoner now in 2020, you should watch the whole thing. It's interesting. Whatever order you choose to watch it in, that's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think the order we watched it in is sufficient.
It's fine. I think there are some episodes that are misplaced, but overall, I think it's a fine order.
But here is my seven episode cut of The Prisoner.
Okay.
Are you ready for
yeah,
it?
Hit me.
It's Arrival.
Yep.
It's The Chimes of Big Ben.
Yep.
It is, The Schizoid Man.
Yep.
Because that's my favorite, like, weird side episode. It is Many Happy Returns.
Yep.
It's Hammer into Anvil.
Yep.
And then it's Once Upon a Time in Fallout.
Yep.
Easy, breezy, beautiful cover girl.
Yep,
and
that's correct.
Maybe in that order.
I think that is 100% correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Those are the episodes.
Arrival, Chimes of Big Ben, Schizoid Man. What did you say next? Hammer into Anvil.
Yeah. Maybe Hammer and Anvil could go earlier.
No, I think Hammer and Anvil has to go after Many Happy Returns.
Okay, yeah. Many Happy Returns and Hammer and Anvil.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Because that gives you the full arc of, like, the different levels to which the village fucks with him. I think you kind of if you could make it an 8-episoder, you kind of want to see one slightly more normal approach before Chimes of Big Ben, the huge like gaslight episode, the first one of that kind. But
like Free for All, maybe.
Yeah, Free for All.
Checkmate.
Well, Free for All is bizarre. I think like Checkmate or something like that.
Does Dance of the Dead fit into your order at all? Because I know you like that episode a lot.
I appreciated it as a sort of like second episode right after the pilot, but it doesn't make the best 7. I don't think Checkmate really does either, but I think Checkmate is more instructive about like the world of the village and what's true and what's not true. But yeah, I don't know. I think the only possible adjustments I would make, I think there's a place for A, B, and C for the sort of like going through, that's a cooler way to go through his past than Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling. I think you can just lose Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling in whatever version you end up constructing.
Even a 16-episode cut with everything but that.
Yeah, I think you still have the full value of the show. I think you can lose Living in Harmony. I think you can lose...
You definitely lose The General.
Yeah, you can lose The General. It's not that interesting. I think you can lose Girl Who Was Death, but you could keep it if you want something fun. Like, I think we genuinely had fun with that episode.
Yeah, it's a well-made episode.
Yeah, but I think your 7 is the right 7.
I love it when I'm right, dude. I really do.
Yeah, you pretty much crushed it. So I think if you want, yeah, like a genuine 7, you just do those. And that's how you do it. And I think the only ways I would rearrange the order that we saw on Amazon is I would just move Dance of the Dead to 2nd, and then I would move Checkmate to 3rd, and then Chimes of Big Ben. And then otherwise, I think it's fine the way that it is.
Because the thing I like about Chimes of Big Ben being earlier, because a lot of these orders put it 5th, which I think is still fine, but, you know, I want to, like, forget who Leo McKern is and have that sort of, like, hazy memory of, like, wait, I do know you. And, like, the show gives you enough, you know, recap to remind you that, like, this guy was a number 2 before.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And then you need the last 2, of course.
Right.
The show doesn't work without Arrival, Once Upon a Time, and Fallout. Like, your real, like, true night, machete cut is Arrival, Once Upon a Time, Fallout, and Go to Sleep. Go do something else.
That's funny. You want to hear the version? Okay, how about this? I'll let you choose. You can hear one of these orders, and then you can review if it's good or not.
Okay.
So you could hear the order that is the official ITC sequence, which is how... Oh, no, that's the original. That's what we watched, so ignore that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can hear the Scott Appel reordering for the PBS affiliate San Jose in the 80s. You could hear the version endorsed by the Prisoner Appreciation Society used in the A&E DVDs. Or you can hear the AV Club reordering. Which of those do you want?
I want Scott Appel's.
Okay, cool. I'll give you Scott Appel's order and you tell me if it's good.
Hit me with it, baby.
All right. So Scott Appel says, first, Arrival. Then, perfect. Oh my gosh. Sorry. This Wikipedia page is actually really great. We should link this because you can click it to have it sort the episodes so that they're in the order of the order that you are.
Ooh.
Looking at, which is very fun. Okay, so Scott Appel's order goes Arrival, Dance of the Dead, Checkmate, Chimes of Big Ben, Free for All, Many Happy Returns. Way too early for that.
Yeah, wow.
Jesus, Scott. The Schizoid Man, The General, A, B, and C, Living in Harmony, It's Your Funeral, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, A Change of Mind, Hammer into Anvil, The Girl Who Is Death, Once Upon a Time, Fallout.
No, Scott, you put all the bad episodes right before the end, Scott.
Yeah, that's such a slog.
Oh my God.
That's such a slog. It is interesting to place Many Happy Returns right before they start cloning him and going into his dreams. So maybe that is good, but that's a wacky order. I kind of want to know the one that the Prisoner Society endorses, so can I read
that
one?
Go for it. Go ahead. Okay. Sure.
So he goes, or sorry, So the Prisoner Society one goes Arrival, Free For All, Dance of the Dead. It's weird doing Free For All second, huh?
Hmm.
Arrival, Free For All, Dance of the Dead, Checkmate, The Chimes of Big Ben, A, B, and C, The General, The Schizoid Man, Many Happy Returns, It's Your Funeral, A Change of Mind, Hammer Into Anvil, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, Living in Harmony, The Girl Who Was Death, Once Upon a Time, Fallout.
So that one's, I think that's better. However,
I think it's better, yeah.
Why does everyone want to put The Girl Who Was Death right before the end? What do you do? Why?
Every single order has it as episode 15, except the production order. But yeah, every single one puts it third to last.
I mean, it's fine. It's fine. What's the one with the barber who's actually like his friend?
The one with the barber where he wants to kill number two?
Yeah, the assassination plot.
That one is Change of Mind?
Chat's drinking game every time Magellan goes pew.
Not Change of Mind. It's Your Funeral, I think.
Okay. I want that one to be later.
Yeah, I think that one goes closer to the end. But yeah, those are the prisoner orders. I think everyone should make their own order. That's what Patrick McGoohan would have wanted, for us to be independent thinkers.
Yeah. Don't watch the show the way they tell you to, especially in a show where some of them are not even connected, really. Like, just find an order that you find is fun. Give me the Angelo Mascot cut. That's only the scenes where he's in it, and he's in the background or he's in the foreground. And then have it conclude with, just him watching number six in London. Oh, that'd be such a good cut. Please, somebody make me that. That's a lot of work, I know. Yeah. You'd basically have to rewatch the whole show and thumb through the entire series, but just give me the scenes of him being involved, and I'll be happy. God, I like The Prisoner a lot. Can I say that?
Yeah, me too. I'm glad we watched it.
Me too. I really hope that people enjoyed hearing us discuss it. We've had some good discussions with people like on Twitter and stuff about it, but it's also not... You know, sometimes I feel hesitant when we don't do like long popular cult sci-fi shows because that attracts a different crowd.
Yeah.
But I think The Prisoner was like worth it for us as like an exercise in like, hey, this show is important. Why is it important? Is it good? Does it hold up? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It does.
It does. I think it's worth watching. And then I think it's really more than a lot of shows I've seen. It really asks you to puzzle out what's going on and make your own meaning out of it. I mean, exemplified by us, like, thinking about if we wanted to reorder it or not. Because you can do that. You can put it in whatever order you want. You can say it's about whatever you want. And it's a show that encourages you to do that in ways that not all TV successfully does. So for that reason, I really appreciate the show.
And I appreciate everyone who worked on it, despite... The chaos behind some aspects of production, I think it comes together really well by the end. Unfortunately, this is not the last Prisoner piece of content that they made.
Yeah.
Well, at least the people who worked on this show were, you know, I don't know how many of them are even alive anymore, but AMC in the year 2009 made a decision. They made a whole decision, and that decision was, what if we remade The Prisoner? And to that I say, you guys already fucked up. You already thought, what if we remade The Prisoner? You've fundamentally made a mistake. But they did it, and they got 6 episodes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to watch those 6 episodes over the next week, and we're going to talk about them next time.
Yep. Yeah, we're not going to do 2 episodes of things spaced out or whatever. We're not going to do that. We're just going to watch the whole thing and then talk about the whole thing, basically.
Yeah. So we can use that interim for people who want to talk about The Prisoner at 67 or other shows like it. If you have like wrap-up emails or questions, you know where to send them. And we will be watching, like I said, the AMC Prisoner, and we'll talk about that next week as we say bye-bye to Prisoner Chats. So do you want to take it to the plug zone, John?
Yeah, let's do it. I can read sort of the brief summary that I'm getting off of Google, by the way, just to set up.
Oh, please. Sure. Why not?
So this reinterpretation of the hit British cult series from the 1960s stars Jim Caviezel as a man trapped in a foreign world without any knowledge of how he got there. As he begins the acclimation process, number 6, as he's known, discovers others just like him, inhabitants identified by numbers and having no memory of any prior life. They're also under constant surveillance. Trusting no one, 6 is driven to find the truth behind the village and, more importantly, how to escape.
it's become more of a common thing now that we like finish a great chat series and then end on a really bad it's like spin-off. So I mean I'm going into this with negative, but I'm gonna try to like find things to enjoy about it. I'm sure it can't be that bad. There's a rover, there's a guy named Number Six, there's a Number Two, Ian McKellen's in it. Like, come on, you guys, it can't be that bad.
Yeah, it sounds like they made some changes that make it worse. Like, it's gonna be more of like, what's going on? Let's ask questions and answer them. So
this is exactly when people are like, we wanted the original Prisoner to end with like answers. It's like, what happens when you make that in 09 when that's more common?
So
we'll find out.
We will. So we can get into the plugs. You want to tell folks how to find us and all that stuff?
Oh, I do, Daddy. Oh, I do.
Confess to me, baby. I forgot that line from the from Fallout.
Confess to me, baby.
Confess to me, baby.
Hey folks, it's Alan. If you would like to email us questions, comments, or concerns about The Prisoner, about chats, about any other chat season, we highly recommend you send us those emails over at chatspod@gmail.com. That is chatzpod@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter at chatspod, where you can send us questions and follow us there for updates about the show. As I recently posted over there, now that Avatar The Last Airbender is on Netflix, at least in the United States, we highly recommend people check out our Chats Season 4, which is Avatar The Last Chatspender, where we watched that show 2 episodes a week and talked about it. And John watched it for the first time, so you can watch it for the first time with him.
Yeah, you should do that.
You can also rate us on Apple Podcasts or your platform of choice if you like the show. And if you would like to support us, we highly, highly encourage you to check out our Patreon over at patreon.com/chatspod. We're at just $3 a month. You can support the show and get a plethora of bonus content, including film commentaries, behind-the-scenes podcasts, as well as Pilot Chats, another show where we watch pilots of shows and determine their chatsability. And all that stuff is voted on by the patrons, what we watch, what we discuss. And you can be one of those patrons by heading over to patreon.com/chatspod. Instead of our usual like personal plugs, we do what's called chatsums here, which is where we recommend you a piece of media, an idea, a concept, something spiritual, whatever you want, conceptual. And it's time for those. So, Magellan, what is your chatsum for this week?
I have 2 chatsums. Folks know, if they've been following my chatsums, I've been getting more back into video games lately in this new state of life that we're in. And I recently purchased the game Star Wars Battlefront 2, the new one, not the original Star Wars Battlefront.
Although, shout out to the old one.
Well, yeah, of course. It's a freaking classic. I loved Star Wars Battlefront and Battlefront 2. I bought Star Wars Battlefront 2 at a Scholastic Book Fair. Just a fun fact.
Wow.
And played the heck out of it when I was a kid. So we used to... the trick... I think we did this. What?
I'm sorry. You said we used to, and then you paused, and all I heard, my brain is so broken by this podcast, dude, was we used to build things from the newsroom. Yeah. God damn.
What my brother and I used to do is we had a laptop in the house and then the desktop, and so we would like load up Battlefront 2 or like Jedi Outcast also. And then we would take the disc out of the computer when the game was loaded up and put it in the other computer and load it up there so that we could play with each other with only one copy of the game.
That's some brilliant piracy right there. Yeah.
But I really loved the original Battlefront 2, and so I was excited to check this one out. And it's good. I mean, I think there are ways in which the original just felt good, and this one doesn't feel quite as good to play. There's some weirdness around. There's like loot boxes and skins and all this sort of modern multiplayer stuff that I think it's more noise than signal, really.
Mm-hmm. Great way to refer to that,
but it looks gorgeous, you know. It really, really feels like you're in a battle in Star Wars. Like you're just a soldier and there's all this shooting going on and there's a dude over there with a friggin' lightsaber and there's a giant tank over that way. And I think it does a better job actually than the original of communicating scale, both the scale of the battle you're in and also the scale of like me versus that tank. I can't just like hop into it or punch it and it blows up or whatever. There's actually this feeling of like, there's no way I can fight that. I need to run away right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
The space combat looks really cool. I am not good at it yet to know if it is the space combat that's messed up or if I just can't fly, but, it's fun. So if you have any fondness for the original Battlefront 2, I think it's an interesting experience to see, you know, after a decade of games making, what are the ideas that that game can now pull from to be different, and which of those ideas actually improve the game and which detract from what was good about the original experience. So that's my Battlefront 2 take.
Very well said. Very well. Is that like, that's cheaper than full price right now?
It was like $40 or something like that. Maybe a little less. Not bad. I mean, you're essentially just buying a multiplayer experience, right? So like, I mean, there is a single player campaign, I suppose. I didn't look into it yet. So I don't know how robust it is. But it,
as I understand, it's not very robust.
So it feels justified that it's cheaper because you're really just paying to do the online multiplayer. And the other recommendation I have is also video games related. It's a podcast though. It's a podcast called The Besties, which is hosted by the McElroy brothers who were involved in the founding of Polygon, Justin and Griffin, as well as two other people who were involved in the founding of Polygon, Russ Frushtick and the other guy whose name I can't remember.
Chris Plant.
Thank you. So it's the four of them, and it's like, we're best friends talking about the best games, the besties, cute. And what they had been doing with their show is covering new games, but now what they're doing, because production of those sorts of things has slowed and is inevitably delayed in some cases, or delayed without, is that inevitably delayed? I don't know if that's what that means, but you know what I mean.
I understand what you mean.
What they're doing instead is they had their listeners vote on the best year in games, and then they're going through and playing and talking about games from that year. So their listeners picked the year 2007, and so far they've done a few episodes. They've talked about Portal. They've talked about Call of Duty Modern Warfare. They've talked about BioShock. So I really like the experience of listening to people who were sort of coming into the beginning of their career as video game journalists, talking about the year where that really started for them, and just getting into this time capsule of like, what was the aughts like? Oh yeah, people were saying the cake was a lie, whatever. But so it's just such a cool time capsule, and they have really fun discussions about those things. And it makes me think that like that should be their podcast actually. And
like that's a more fun idea than
just
talking
about new stuff. Yeah, so I would recommend those episodes of The Besties specifically as my second chatsum. What about you? What are you recommending this week?
My chatsum's a little more broad. Nothing in particular, but kind of a reminder for those who are following the stay-at-home orders of their various states and nations. You're allowed to go outside still. You know, if you keep a mask on, I highly encourage you, especially as we get into the summer, to go for walks. Magellan and I and our friend James have been getting into running as sort of a way to expend energy and kind of feel a little bit more physically fit. I've been running probably every other day for the last 2 weeks, and it's been really, really good for me. I think both, especially mentally, but also physically, it's like helped with my resting heart rate and just like comfort with like my diet and like the days that I now can feel okay staying at home and not working out. Whereas when I was going to the gym before quarantine, you know, the days that you don't go, you feel bad. But like with running, you have to take breaks. You literally like cannot be a successful runner unless you take full rest days, as I understand it. And I've been following basically a day by day guide that comes from the Mayo Clinic that kind of, it's like, hey, in these 7 weeks, if you follow this every day, you will be ready to run a 5K in 7 weeks, which is really exciting. And I can link that for folks if they're interested, because it kind of accommodates people's different physical capability. You know, a lot of like running stuff is like, oh, if you do a mile a day, you'll be in shape. Or if you do 3 miles every once a week, you'll be in shape. Like all these things that like, well, if you can't reach it, then tough. But, you know, specifically like the Mayo Clinic running guide is like, you know, do 30 minutes of either walking or running, whatever you can manage. And then by Saturday, try to run this X number of miles.
Yeah.
Like pushing yourself for distance and for just hitting milestones as opposed to like hitting speed or time, you know, just like do what you can within your means, which I think is a much more equitable way to get people into taking care of their physical health than this like, you must lift 100 pounds and you must increase your weight, which is like how a lot of like weightlifting stuff has to go, is much more rigid. So, you know, just try and take care of your physical self. I know we're, and you shouldn't feel bad if you're not, obviously, but within your means, take care of yourself. That's always good advice, I think.
Definitely.
So thank you, as always, to Magellan for being the rock to my hard place. Thanks for listening, and
be seeing you.